Hi, Carolyn here from We Teach Well. Our mission is to promote educational equality by providing English and literature teachers, wherever they may teach, with truly borderless professional development options. We are inviting writers and educators from around the world to share the cultural and historical issues that sit behind the literature of their country. Today, we are back talking with Angela Tutte about New Zealand literature. I hope you enjoyed the first half of the podcast. And if you missed it, you can go back and find it. It'll be on our website or on Spotify and iTunes. The reason there are two parts to this episode is that the interview with Angela was so full of good information and helpful suggestions for dealing with not only New Zealand texts, but Indigenous texts from any country. Conversations with Angela always last for a long time because her brain never stops functioning. I'm sure you're looking forward to this second half as Angela talks more and deeply about the literature of New Zealand. Put your feet up. Stick in your headphones, go for a walk, whatever it is that you prefer to do, and join us as we hear more from Angela. I think it's so important, as you said earlier, in order to understand New Zealand literature, you have to understand New Zealand culture. And I think that's the same with any literature, and why we think it's so important that people talking about German literature. So I've got a friend, I'm trying to convince her to do it. Talking about the, even just the classics, that you need to have grown up in Germany. You need to be German to understand the world in which these texts were created. We can't just trust British, you know, old white British, mostly male, viewpoints in how we are going to interpret literary texts. But that's enough for me because it's much more about you today. Are there elements of New Zealand life that are encoded within the characters in the texts? You know, those conventions, they're not rules, they're not codified, they're not written down anywhere. But if you're from New Zealand, you know that thongs are called something else.
Yeah, they're called jandals. Yeah, and we have I guess Maori films do it much better. You know, when I think of something like Boy, Boy's set in 1984, and that's just the way they roll. And you see them doing things that we very much, you know, grew up with. And if I remember the 1980s and the 70s, you know, if you look back now, it's a bit embarrassing. But that was the way it was. And we do have this whole language of our own. And we know that, you know, when we see that's New Zealand. You know, you've got your jandals and you've got your jaffers and you've got your chili bins, and it's all very much the Kiwi lang and the bro, right. and that's your cuz, your bro, so BRO. Yep. So my son has a chosen family that is boys that he's okay. grown up with, and that's it. You know, you're all related, but none of you are actually related by blood, but you create everything. I kind of think in New Zealand comes back to whānau. It comes back to family. And that doesn't mean to say there aren't broken families, because there are, but your family doesn't have to be that you're born into. You kind of, wherever you go, you create. And you'll know this, Carolyn, because having lived overseas, that's what we do naturally. We create a new family because you're away with all these randoms, and half the time you haven't got anyone from your family. And I think in a lot of characters, you see the innocence of the country. Very much it is about young, it's about the young people, and they've got that little bit of innocence before they find the children before they become the teenagers. I think in a lot of characters in New Zealand, you see that innocence, which is very much, New Zealand's still got an innocence about it, which I think Australia's perhaps lost a lot more. But that's because it's got this small town attitude, and like everybody knows everybody, and that's the kind of thing that I often see in the characters, and I don't know. It just, I always get a feeling that it's beautiful, and it doesn't matter what part they're in. Somewhere, and it seems to be in every film that you watch, they end up in the bush somewhere. And I think that's part of being in New Zealand. And I don't know. It's an attitude, and I don't know how to. Like a perfect example is that. Last year, my school was teaching Hunt for the Wilder People. And I kept saying, I don't know. Look, it's a great film to watch, and I love it. But there's something about it that is so New Zealand that if you don't understand the people, then you don't understand the actual context. You don't understand the film. You know, about this little boy that's lost and he's looking for a family, and so often that comes up, and I think of so many of the Janet Frame wrote about family. Alan Duff, it was about family and the importance of family, and that, you know, you stick together, and it doesn't matter if we're doing the wrong thing, we're going to stick together. And I think New Zealanders are very patriotic people, and they're very proud of their country. And I look at my friends that are all over the world, and just relating back to, it's almost like it's okay, bro. You know, a wee bit more relaxed. And I think you often see that in the characters from New Zealand. They're a wee bit more quirky, and doing odd things is okay. So it's okay to go to the supermarket in your gumboots, and it's okay to not wear any shoes, and it's okay to ride behind you on your bike that's got no brakes or gears on the bus. I guess the difference I think in a lot of characters is that I feel often they're still in the 1980s. And some people in New Zealand would be horrified by that, but it was really cool to be in the 80s to really not care if you were a bit odd. Because really, we're all a bit odd.
There's a lot of jokes happen in Australia about Kiwis coming across, and we're really good at appropriating New Zealanders, like Sam Neill and Russell Crowe, sorry, just as examples. We're really good at calling them Australian, and I think the you mentioned briefly about how beautiful it is, and it is. And that's what I think most people in the world would know now, because when they think of New Zealand, they think of Lord of the Rings. And the sheer beauty. But I had a little bit of a synapse happen when you were talking there about family, and I was choosing family, and I was thinking about Lord of the Rings and some of the themes in that, in the Tolkien work, about staying close to your people, but also creating new relationships with other people, and creating almost a second family as such, because there were these others who were different from you, but they mattered, and so you invited them in. You know, there was that a sort of an appreciation and acceptance of the other that I think is sadly missing from much of our international discourse, and I think certainly in Australia. And so I just wonder whether that would sort of explain a little bit about that finding another family, you know, finding is an openness and a willingness and acceptance to people who are not blood relatives. They're not, you know, they're new, but you accept them anyway. Would that be?
Yeah, and it's like you find that connection. So it's almost like, I don't know, when there's another Kiwi around, you sniff them out. And of course, I forget about my accent and I'm still getting a hard time about it. And there's something about it that it's almost like your favourite foods, that there's a shop in Melbourne that we go to and it's has a lot of stuff from the Pacific and from New Zealand. And it's when you find your favourite food and the thing you've forgotten, you feel like you're home. And I guess it's like when you're away from your country, you can be taken out of your country, but you can't take the country out of you. No. And I think Kiwi all the time. I still have to translate for my husband some words. And I feel that that's in New Zealand literature. It's like Mr. Pip is not set in New Zealand. It's set in Papua New Guinea. But it's written by a New Zealand author. And it's one of my most favourite texts in the world, because even though it's not set in New Zealand, I can feel the Kiwi in it. It's just there. I don't know what it is. Look, another favourite text of mine is reading Lolita in Tehran.
I haven't read that yet.
You have to read it. It's everything about it is so cool, and I just love that there were these beautiful woman in this country in turmoil who fought to read the classics that definitely weren't about their country, but they fought to read literature and how important it was for them. And I think that that's the best thing about literature, is that you get to read and you get to be in other worlds. And I mean, I'm a prolific reader, I didn't used to like history, and now I teach history. But the reason I got into history was because I read about it and I wanted to know about it. And then I wanted to know if these novels were correct. And it's really easy nowadays because you've got the internet. But in the good old days, we didn't have that. But, I read about Henry VIII and this wife that he cut her head off, and then they start their own church. So that's, that's a wonderful thing about literature. It opens the world to us. And I think if you approach it with an open mind, like you, when I was in Singapore, it used to do my head in that they were reading all this stuff from England.
Yep.
And I purposely went to Takashimaya, because that's the best bookshop in the world, and bought Asian literature. I read people that Lisa C, who probably wouldn't be my favourite kind of writer, but I learnt so much about the Hungry Ghosts, and I learnt all about this, about the country, about the people through reading literature. I had a friend who was going to teach global politics, and I said to her, "Have you read Wild Swans?" She said, "No." I said, "Well, how can you teach about China if you don't actually know about the history? Wild Swans is perfect. It goes over three generations." And I don't need to tell you, Carolyn, because you're the queen of it.
You're preaching to the choir here. I did my grad dip ed at Melbourne University because they were the only place that would let me do a double English method. Everybody else wanted me to do SOS or science. I'm not really interested in anything else. That's where I have learnt my history from. Obviously, I was young in the old, very olden days when they taught British history and various other types of history solidly in primary and high school. But most of my history knowledge has come from reading novels, drama, plays.
And I love the way that, you know, that they're prepared to face the violence. Because let's be realistic, our Indigenous history is violent, no matter which country we go to. I mean, I've taught Hotel Rwanda.
I love that film.
Yeah, and so many I look at that, like, the best part about teaching 20th century history is in term four, you get to do two conflicts. I mean, we did a whole year of conflicts, but you get to choose two conflicts. So I decided for my class that I would choose a conflict and they would choose a conflict. So I said, I'm going to model and you're going to follow. So I looked for the conflict that probably, you know, stands out the most for me, and the man that changed the conflict and looked at Mandela and being anti-apartheid. You know, and I just love the way that of the authors that are prepared to confront it and say, this actually happened. We need to be I've just bought a new book on a recommendation from a young man at the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery. It's actually eavesdropping. But he was talking to these people who I feel lived in Australia but were definitely from a different country, that had quite a strong accent. Yeah. And he was showing them an image of these white men and Truganini. And so he recommended this book that had been written about Truganini. So I've just bought that. And
is that the last?
It is.
Or the last something?
Yeah. So I'm just trying to find you the author. And I love the way he was talking about, and I think this is, he made a very good point. Yes, it's called Truganini: Journey Through the Apocalypse, and it's by Cassandra Pybus. Anyway, he said it was the best one written, but he made a really good point because he said, oh, you know, they said she was the last Aborigine in Tasmania. No, last full-blooded Aborigine. And he said, it doesn't matter how much milk you add to a cup of tea, it's still a cup of tea. Mm. And I thought, I've heard that a couple of times now. And if you, especially in the South Island of New Zealand, if you look, you know, in your class and you look down your roll, there'll be, well, I have three Maori grandchildren, and two of them are don't look any different to their cousins. And I think that just because you look and you don't know that the people are Indigenous, good enough. You have to. And I think it's quite hard here when you're doing your VIT registration and they ask you about when I'm doing it with new teachers. Early career teachers, and they go, but I haven't taught any Aboriginal people. And we're lucky now, we've actually got a couple of students in our school, so it's good for the staff. And and their parents are quite proactive, which I think's exciting, that they're prepared to say, you know, well, why aren't you doing this? So that's exciting to see that's happening.
Because looking back, there haven't been any that I have yet read about, any Indigenous people in any country that I've read about who were not treated violently by colonial forces and expansion. And that was not just the British, the Spanish, the French,
the Dutch.
The Dutch of them.
I couldn't understand I've since read it, but when I saw the film, The Power of One.
Yep.
And I couldn't get it to add up. What were these white people doing in this there? And, you know, and then you've got to go back and look at the history and you've got to look at the colonisation. Mm. And I guess it's just something that's bred into races, that this want to be the control. I teach all the 20th century, so that's all about people wanting to be taking over other people's lands. But what I think that perhaps is missed, and I find it really interesting talking to British colleagues, because they, of course, live in a different world. I mean, their country now has got a lot more nationalities, but I think the land is what is, so that would be whenua in New Zealand. So the land, the Māori say they're the people of the land, the importance for the Aboriginal people of country, their country, being connected. And, Young Dark Emu, we're starting to teach that, and I'm just loving that, because it just gives a really different perspective to what we thought. The limited knowledge I have that I was taught about, we were taught about the Indigenous Australians in New Zealand, which I thought was quite good when I went to school, but I thought they were nomadic, and then you find out about the agriculture and all that, and I find that really exciting that Bruce Pascoe has put out this. He's telling us, he's informing us, he's making us aware, and I think that's the whole thing, is that's what literature does, and that's why you've got to be prepared to face the violence. And, I think when Once Were Warriors came out, and it was just horrific, and, they were teaching it in year 13, which would be year 12 here, they were teaching it in the English class, and it was done so well. The teacher was actually Australian, and, you didn't want to look at it, you didn't want to confront it, but you needed to be realistic. And that wasn't just happening in Māori households, it was happening across the board. But he was prepared to show the perspective, and to show, lots of good things, but lots of heartache.
Here's a question then. It was an Australian teaching it. Listen to a podcast, Professor Larissa McLean-Davies from Melbourne Graduate School of Education was talking about the difficulty of getting teachers in Australia to teach Australian texts, and how they felt uncomfortable with teaching texts that showed racist ideas and stuff. But they were still able to teach To Kill a Mockingbird and 12 Angry Men. And I wonder whether we can teach somebody else's dark side, but we're not so comfortable teaching our own.
I think especially here, that's a good point. It horrifies me that's what teachers say, that they... I know some of it's fear because they don't want to muck it up, but isn't it better to try, and you might get a little bit wrong, but at least you're showing that you respect. I find it really incredible that, I was in Tasmania, which I absolutely adore. I guess it's like being at home. And we went to Port Arthur. And we'd also been to the museum, I've told you that. And I said to my husband, it blows me away that, there's some incredible things that have happened in Australia's history. Mile Creek Massacre and the changing of the law in Australia. I also teach law and economics. And then you look at something like Martin Bryant and the horrendous massacre, and how Australia, what they did, they were so proactive. In fact, after the mosque massacre in New Zealand, they looked to the changing of the gun laws in Australia for guidance to see what they'd done, because they'd changed it so quickly. But we don't really talk about those things. It's like, well, why not? It's come from something bad, but something good came out of it. And I think that's really important. And I'm really impressed at Port Arthur how they have preserved the history, but they have also acknowledged the horrific thing that happened there in a very tasteful way.
Yeah.
And it doesn't overshadow everything else, because I think, you know, Port Arthur's about the history and that's the important bit. But I think we've got to be more realistic, and we've got to start talking about the skeletons in our closet, you know.
Guns. So why don't we have guns? You're right. We need to teach these things. Why was suddenly Australia able to do a massive buyback or whatever, and without any real pushback? That idea of living in a place where they don't have guns, we're accustomed to it, but an American perhaps teaching the texts wouldn't know about that. But you're right, we do need to teach these things.
I agree. Yeah, we do. We do. We need to teach the ugly things as well as the good things. And if you don't understand where you've come from, you can't go forward.
That's right. How can you go forward when you...
Yeah, and when I look at literature in New Zealand and some incredible literature, and some of it's from a white perspective and some of it's from a Maori perspective and some of it's just a perspective. Yeah. And I think that's, I find it very difficult to sum up New Zealand, because I think that's it. It is, it's, I see it as a bicultural country. I mean, it's actually multicultural now, yeah. But the commitment certainly in the classroom, and certainly their commitment also is to Pacific Islanders, yeah. A major part of the North Island. There are a lot of Pacific Island families, and that's going to become more of a reality with things like climate change. But I guess it's this, and Singapore really helped to open my eyes even more that, you know, you may not agree, but you need to respect. And I mean, Singapore had it in law, which is, I guess, is a bit more what Singapore's like. But the fact that I often talk to people about how there's lots of religions in Singapore, but the main religions get two public holidays a year each. And I think that, you know, you don't have to agree, but you have to accept, but you have to realise it and everybody's history, doesn't matter what country you look, I can't think of one country that's got a clean slate, but you need to know about the history and you need to know about the bad stuff. And it's, you don't know what you don't know, and I guess maybe that's a fear about teaching. I mean, I just ball busted in. I got thrown straight into teaching Australian history. Mm. Okay, well, I had a limited knowledge, but I use literature to upskill me, and I don't always get it right, but I'm not frightened to teach about Indigenous Australia. No. I think it's and we're continually looking for texts so that we can share the perspective at a level, and that's why I love the black cockatoo. Mm. I mean, we've taught a few over the years. And, you know, when you were talking before about the teaching of the 12 angry men, of course I laugh because, you know, when we look at what VCAR are telling us that we should be teaching at year 12, well, what we have to teach at year 12, there's some Indigenous texts there, but there's still things like 12 Angry Men and things like that. There's still a lot of texts that, and I've taught a lot of texts that I've thought were very, very white perspective.
I don't have a problem with teaching 12 Angry Men or To Kill a Mockingbird, because, I mean, I love them as texts, and it lets me show them films like Mississippi Burning and introduce them to the riots and things that have happened in other countries because of, you know, racism. What I object to is that they're the only ones they teach.
Yeah.
Some of my younger colleagues get tired of hearing this, but I'm pretty sure when I went back to do year 12, so I was about 23, was signed 1978, maybe. I did English and literature. And we read 6 or 8 texts in English, and we read 8 in literature.
That would kill the students today, but...
Because we did some Australian ones. We did David Martin's The Young Wife, about a young Greek woman who's brought over here to marry a husband. We also did Dostoevsky and Chekhov. It's fine to teach 12 Angry Men, but only if there's room in what you're doing for other things.
It still amazes me here that Australia's got some of the best authors in the world.
I know.
And they're not being taught in classrooms. They're not, from whatever perspective. I mean, I'm really lucky at my school because the head of English is very much on top of it and very much about teaching Australian text. And we have some wonderful people in our middle years who are really pushing that, like, that we are doing the Indigenous texts. And, I mean, I read a lot of Australia. I try to read the country that I'm living in. I try to read their authors. And I went and saw The Dry the other day, which I have read. And it's just wonderful to read something that's so Australian. And I had a friend over yesterday, and we were sitting there and we were talking about Tim Winton. Well, I heard him speak and a couple of years ago when he put out The Shepherd's Heart, and it was just amazing. And he was just, I loved him because he was so natural and just Australian. And I guess maybe that's how I look at New Zealand authors. They're just New Zealand. Peter Jackson, like, he's taken some of the biggest texts in the world and put them on the screen, and The Lovely Bones. I adored that book. I hated the ending, and Peter Jackson changed the ending for the film, and I actually preferred that.
I read the book, but I didn't see the film.
Oh, it's very, very similar, except the ending changes. And I guess it's a hard thing to describe, but they're just their country. They've got something about them that just says, and they're all very natural. Sam Neill, like, he's just amazing as an actor, and he's just so New Zealand, so much so that he's actually got lives down in Queenstown. He's got a vineyard. That's just New Zealand, you know, lots of wine drinking. We like to think that that's what we are. That's the sophisticated side. They're not the people who wear their gumboots to the supermarket. I guess, you know, that's in any society, isn't it? That, you know, you get the different people, the sophisticated people and the not so sophisticated people. And I'm really happy to be in the not so sophisticated. And that's what you need to see in the literature from the country. You need to read The Dry. Not so much because it's about solving a mystery. It's about the cold, the heat, the drought, and the impact of the drought. The piano. When I watched that at the movies, I just about cried and thought, "Is that really what New Zealand was like?" But yes, it was. That was what it was like for the pioneers. It was tough. They were wearing those stupid long dresses in a country that rained a lot. Well, you were going to get dirty. You know, that's all part of the essence of a country, and people can learn so much through the reading of the literature or the viewing of the films. And I guess it always makes you feel like home when you see that, because there's just something about it that says it's home.
Well, on that note, Angela, we should probably wrap up. Thank you so much for your, you've been very generous with your time. But if I could ask you to do something that you said before that you would have trouble doing. If you could recommend up to 3 texts, I'm not going to ask you to just pick one, but up to 3 texts that you think most faithfully represent New Zealand culture, what would they be?
I think Hunt for the Wilder People is a beautiful film. So go back and read the book that it's based on, which is Wild Pork and Watercress, which is written by Barry Crump. And Barry Crump was the last person in the world that you'd pick to be an author. I don't know that he owned any good clothes. He might have. But, like, whenever you see him, he's got on the same hat and he just really looks like he's come off the farm. I think that's what the New Zealand people are about. The New Zealand people, if they say to you, come over, come for a meal, stay the night, they actually mean it. You know, they're not just saying it to be nice. Yeah. And I seem to spend my whole life saying, no, I mean it. I mean it. Actually, come to my house. The door is open. Love to have you. Very hospitable.
I'm not sure that people in Australia know how to do that anymore, because I'm much the same. If I ask you to come over and, you know, come over and have lunch, well, I'm going to keep everything open and available for the next 10 hours. You know, you don't need to leave. But I don't think people do that anymore.
So I think you see that he does that very well. He was a comedian, and so he had a really light way that he looked. And I guess sometimes, a lot of the time, New Zealanders look at things quite lightly, not serious things, but they look at life a wee bit lightly. And, oh, well, you know, it's like the bro. Yeah, she'll be right, mate. Even like, you know, when we're talking before about language, and I think about my husband, when I send him a message, he often sends me back, sweet. Yeah, okay. And that he's not a big talker anyway, but you know, that's his language. Yep. It means yes. Okay. So I think that's Wild Pork and Watercress. Like, there's just so many beautiful authors, and I've mentioned all of them before that actually give a beautiful perspective of New Zealand culture.
Well, maybe you could think about that. And once we've got the list of the ones you've already mentioned, that'll fill up the slots, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's like there's just, I think if you look at authors, you know, like if you look at Witte Itamara or Patricia Grace, that gives the beautiful Māori culture. I mean, Wild Rider, it sums up New Zealand. And there's lots of children's books that Margaret Mahey and people like that who, it's just about New Zealand children, and it's just about kids, and that's what our kids grew up on, and that's an essential part of New Zealand. And you sort of think, sometimes I think I forget, you know, people that I would have, because I haven't lived in New Zealand for, I think it's 11, 12 years now, and I try to read what's happening at the time, where I'm at. David Hill was a great, I taught him when I was at school. He's an easy read for teenage kids. And talking about the volcanoes, that's a way of life in New Zealand, you know, that there's volcanoes and that you just know earthquakes. It's another thing that's a way of life in New Zealand, that you just know that one day you're going to encounter one of those. So I think talking about things like that and about, I guess it's quite hard because there's a range of, you know, there's, when you look at someone like Janet Frame or Kerry Hume, it's quite different literature to, say, Wild Pork and Watercress. So I could probably talk for hours about different...
Absolutely, which is why I said up to three.
You know, like someone like Naomi Marsh, beautiful crime writer.
It's probably time to wind this up.
It's been lovely talking to you.
And to you too, Angela. It's been great to catch up. Best wishes for this year. It's looking like the beginning of the year is still going to be a little odd. Got to hope that it doesn't go backwards. Thank you again. That is the end of the second part of our interview with Angela Tutte, an English teacher from New Zealand. If you missed the first episode or want to go through it again, you can find both parts and all the episodes at our website or in iTunes and Spotify. For more information about our organisation, you can visit us at weteachworld.com. And if you have any questions or would like to send some suggestions of literature you'd like to learn more about, then email us at support@weteachworld.com. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And please, if you are, make sure to like it, share it with your friends, and subscribe to our mailing list so that you can stay up to date with all of our latest news, initiatives, and upcoming episodes.